You're tuned to 88.1 FM KPPP LP Fargo Moorhead. From the People's Press Project, this is Technical Difficulties, the Cripcast. Hashtag Cripcast, Twitter at LightChronic, Facebook search for Technical Difficulties Radio Show. I'm your host, Tim Abbott, and it's Friday, October 21st. For the next hour, joining us down the line from Toronto is the host of Disability After Dark, Andrew Gerza. Good afternoon, Andrew. Welcome to KPPLP.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So what is Disability After Dark?
Well, it's a brand that I started to talk about sexuality and disability. It's really, it's a podcast, it's a lecture series. It's really just a brand that I started to bring disability into disability and sexuality into pop culture, the mainstream.
Where were you, what were you doing before that idea occurred?
Well, I've been talking about the lived experience of disability for 4.5 years now in different brands and different iterations. So I was doing Deliciously Disabled before, which was the same idea. Before all of that, I was studying law and disability east of Toronto for years and years in university. And then before that, I was just a kid growing up just north of Toronto.
You studied law, you said?
Law and disability, yeah.
So was that a dual major, or was that a specific type of law relating to disability?
It was just general law at first, and then for my master's, I decided to study disability law, thinking that I would become this big lawyer in disability rights activism, and very quickly realized that law was not for me, and I wanted to look at the more social aspects of disability and talk about how disability affected me emotionally and the emotional side of that. Plus, I was always a very sexual person, and I always was kind of fascinated by sex, but never really felt like I had a place. So I decided that sex and disability was the area that I wanted to focus on.
Thankfully, there are people for whom law appeals. I went through the same process, or parts of it, when I was studying, looking what to study at college myself. I weighed up law and then decided I'd be learning a lot of useless law in the process of learning the journalism that I wanted to learn. So I just went with a journalism degree. And then fell into doing this show. I used to do it in London, did it in London for 3 years before I emigrated. You said that you I try not to ask people what condition they have, but you spoke about growing up as a disabled person.
Born with cerebral palsy. So I've lived with that since day one. And that manifests itself for me. I'm a wheelchair user. I'm not ambulatory. I'm a wheelchair user. I need a lot of help with my daily living. I need help getting dressed, getting up, showering, all those things I need help with. But other than that, I mean, my disability, it's a part of me culturally. It's how I identify. I'm very proud of my disability because it's given me the chance to work and to tell my story and to all those things. But growing up, my disability wasn't ever something that I really thought about. I just kind of lived my life and did my thing. And then as I got older, as I started becoming a teenager and going through puberty, as we all do, which is so fun, I realized how much my disability was connected to my experience, and that's kind of where I started building a disabled identity from. But my family never made my disability, never made it something that was a huge deal, just kind of dealt with it, we moved on.
The So from that base, you've spoken about being interested in sex. That's what happens to men that are growing up. So where was the transformation point from just growing up with, as a disabled person going through puberty, and actually being interested in it as almost an academic topic?
That kind of came, actually, weirdly enough, from the law stuff that I was studying in my master's, and a little bit before that as well. When I went to university, that's kind of where I had my sexual awakening as a sexual being, because I was away from home. I was free to try whatever I wanted to try, and I was, you know, really kind of wanted to get involved in the queer scene, wanted to meet queer people, and so I would immerse myself in, like, the LGBTQ center at the university, at the college, and I really quickly realized that the center was great, but they had no disability stuff, and so I was really, really kind of like, oh, well, this is weird. You know, how can I be queer and disabled? And I would interact with people and try to have sexual encounters and realize that nobody was really talking about my experience as a disabled queer person. So that's kind of where it grew out of. And then when I was studying in my master's, I was looking at attitudes around law and disability. And as I was doing all that work around attitudes, I realized the attitude around disability and sexuality wasn't being discussed enough, and I wanted to understand why. And so that's kind of where the two worlds kind of came together in an academic sense. But I realized I didn't want to go to school and study sex and disability because I had already done so much school. I wanted to take it on my own and do something else with it. It came from me in terms of how it went from, like, just being into puberty to academia. It came from when I moved to university. I really got the desire to study sex and disability for myself from my master's, actually. My master's looked at law and disability, and part of my master's work was looking at the attitudes around the law and disability. And what I learned was that the attitudes around disability hadn't really changed. And so I was curious of how I also understood during all this time that I was trying to be sexual, I was trying to meet people, I was trying to get into the queer scene. And I also realized there was nothing really for me as a disabled person in these spaces. I didn't feel like I had a place, even when I went into queer spaces, when I tried to access my sexuality. And I realized the attitudes around sex and disability hadn't really changed either. So it's because of my schooling and the work that I was doing in studying disability that I wanted to pair my interest, which was sex, and my academic stuff, which was disability, and kind of bring it together. But I wanted to do so not in an academic sense. I wanted to do so in a pop culture sense that made the conversation around sex and disability more accessible to an audience.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that your identity is both proudly disabled and queer.
Yeah.
So the intersection between those two isn't something I've come across that often or discussed that often. I know queer disabled people, but haven't really discussed the intersection. So explain to me how those two parts of your identity inform or reflect on each other.
They are 1,000,000% intertwined with each other, because if we're just talking about sex, if I want to get sexual with somebody, they have to be well versed in my disability. And then when I go into disabled spaces, I have to also come out as queer. You know queer disabled people, but it's not talked about enough. That's kind of how I feel about the work I do, is that there's so many of us out there but nobody's really talking to us. So I wanted to give a platform to that. And so, I mean, the two identities, I love them together. And when I was coming out as queer at 15, 16, I was always worried about how the two identities would come together. Could I be queer and disabled? Could I? Like, isn't my life hard enough? I'm going to add queerness to that now. It's been a constant journey of coming out and learning how the two identities fit and figuring out if they could fit. And so that's something that's never really stopped. And I don't think will ever really stop. And I think the more and more that I put myself out there and that I, you know, champion the queer disabled community, the way that hearing you say, like, oh, we don't hear about it so much, hopefully with what I'm doing and with what other people who are working in that field do, the conversation will shift to, oh yeah, there are a bunch of people, I know that, yeah. So, I mean, that's the goal of what I do, but the two identities strongly inform each other, and I really wouldn't have it any other way.
There is, I think, in this decade particularly, I've noticed there's more intersectional awareness. There's more awareness that there can be queer disabled people or black disabled people, or, well, I was always a male disabled person, but that there can be specifically female disabled conversation and lesbian disabled conversation and all the split-offs that you could think of, possible combinations. And I noticed that you're friends with Leroy Moore. And yeah. Crip-hop is an interesting subset where intersectional awareness is key to that, is awareness that it's not just about disability, that there's an overlay, particularly with Crip-hop, an awareness of the added problems that race causes.
Totally, yeah. I think stuff like Crip-hop is, I just think, I don't know Leroy super well. We're Facebook friends, and we've said hi like once or twice. But I think that when people start talking about the intersections of race and disability and sexuality and disability and really embracing those intersections, I think it's just really cool because it adds another layer of stuff we can talk about and stuff we can and different levels of diversity. Because you could say that I'm just disabled and that's a diversity point, and you could say I'm just queer and that's a diversity point. But if you put them together, it's like a whole other cultural discussion that I think it's very timely that we have it now.
Well, there's an obvious thing to ask you as somebody based in Canada. Our audience is kind of international. When people have listened to the previous version of Technical Difficulties, they came from both sides of the Atlantic. So there may well be people listening to this show that are on the other side of the Atlantic, but even if they're not, people in America need some kind of idea what it's like to be you in Canada. So both the disabled and the queer and the intersection, what makes it different than if you were a few miles further south? And Toronto is virtually on the border, but go on.
Yeah. I don't really think it's that much different if I was in the States, simply because we don't talk about it in either country, whether it be in the U.S. or in Canada. We don't see disability and sex as something we can talk about. So I've taken my lecture series all over Canada and all over the U.S., looking at universities, talking about the same stuff, and I get the same reactions from people that are, oh, we're going to talk about sex and disability? Okay, you can be queer and disabled? Wow, I didn't know that. So the conversations are really really very, very similar.
Is there coming from a country, having emigrated from a country with universal healthcare, there's this...
Isn't it the best?
Yeah, except that there's this belief that it solves every problem. So it's very useful, but it's because it's tax funded, it's underfunded, because people always argue about it. So yeah. Are there, I don't know, are there any myths that you want to squash about it? You just said it's the best. So tell me your experience of it. Squash any myths you want to squash about Canadian healthcare.
I guess if we're talking about Canadian healthcare, first I should point out the thing that Trump said a few weeks ago where he was like, Canadian healthcare is a disaster. It's not. It's pretty good given that it's free, but I will agree with you in terms of, it being underfunded, the wait times are quite long. And I think just because it's free doesn't mean, to bring it back to disability, just because it's free doesn't mean they understand about disability. And I think that's a similarity between the U.S. and Canada, in that when you go into a hospital and you're living with a disability, the doctors don't seem to know what to do with you. They don't know how to treat you properly. Whenever I go to a healthcare practitioner, I have to explain to them how my disability works in relation to whatever's wrong with me. I can't just be sick and have them know what to do. I think it's great that it's free in Canada, but on both sides of the border, there needs to be more disability awareness training as to how to treat somebody and how to treat a patient with disabilities and how to have like special equipment in doctor's offices so that they can be lifted out of their wheelchairs if they need to, special equipment in the hospital, special training for how to lift, just to learn how to talk to somebody with a disability. So it's great, but I agree with you, there are a lot of problems, especially if you're adding in intersectionality such as disability into the mix.
To roll back to the cross-section that you're looking at in particular, sexual interaction is a very private experience normally for the majority of the population. It doesn't involve extra people, AIDS or otherwise.
Right.
So that must present an added element. It does. I have a sexual life myself, but you're the guest, so I'll let you speak on the nature of adding. I mean, I don't. Thankfully, I'm ambulatory enough not to need an extra person in the room to help me.
Right.
You talk about things that are public and need to be well understood, and you need disability awareness in the healthcare system. When you get to sex, you're suddenly in a situation where you want as much privacy as possible. Go on. Talk to me about your experience of that. There we are.
You do want privacy. You do, for sure. But when I don't typically involve an aid for my sex life, what I'll do is if I'm having sex with a partner, I will train the partner as to what I need, and I will lay it out with them beforehand so that they know what they're getting into before we start doing anything, and I'll make clear that I don't want to bring some random third person in here that's not going to be joining us for the sexual encounter, because that's odd. So I'd like you to know what you're doing. And I give them a kind of a primer into how to connect with me sexually. And then I teach them. And then I think that creates a level of intimacy that I really enjoy. Like, I like being able to show a partner how my sling works and show a partner how I need to be undressed and show a partner all these things. Because for me, it makes the sex that much better and that much more connected. And that's something that I really crave. I enjoy connecting with people that I sleep with. And I think a lot of times in the queer community, at least in my experience, the queer male community, we don't connect enough emotionally when we're having sex. Mm. We tend to just kind of have sex, and then thanks for the sex, bye. And that's not really how I operate. I'm very emotionally connected to the experiences I have. So to be able to show a partner that, and to share that with a partner, to share that, it's a big deal. So I like to vet my partners before I just say, come over, we'll do things. I want to make sure they're comfortable, and I want to make sure they understand, because bringing you into that part of my life is a big deal for me. So I don't want to just do it willy-nilly. I want to make sure you're somebody that's worthy of sharing that experience with.
Yeah, I guess what's something that occurs to me is that, again, at the intersection of so many different elements, it's hard. I've got CP as well. I was born with it. And
oh, cool! You're one of us. Hi.
Yeah. I you can't tell. I have, in terms of my throat and stuff, I sound. There's no muscle problems there at all. Although there are kind of now. There weren't. I am. And yes, hi. We have a motorized bed.
So
that's kind of funky and very useful. So you just kind of, okay, yeah, you need this angle. And I entirely get what you're saying. It sounds a bit like obedience school, but yeah, there was an extent to which I had to train my wife to understand, mostly just to get out that hurts means... ow, that hurts, not carry on. That's nice. If it's nice pain, I won't say ow, that hurts. If I'm trapped,
I have
hemiparesis, so like, you know, I'll just, my left arm will just get trapped under something, and I was like, no, this actually hurts, stop.
Oh no, I can't move. But anybody with CP, both of our levels of CP, we've all been there where you're like, okay, I'm stuck, I can't, oh no, what do I do? I think in terms of pain and consent, I think that's why people with disabilities should, what I'll refer to as storyboard your sex, which is before you have sex with somebody, you sit them down and you draw pictures and you have a discussion and you write stuff down and you talk about the realities of what is going to happen and what you want to do versus what you can do, so that you get a sense of like what their needs are versus what their wants are. And then by the time you have the sex there, you know, it's a lot less scary to do it, because you're not worried, oh my god, am I going to hurt him? You've talked about what is possible so that each party is comfortable and satisfied.
Yeah, I get the impression that you are dating rather than settled with a particular partner. Is that correct?
Big sigh. I wish I was dating. I've never actually dated somebody properly. I've had a lot of one-night stands that didn't go anywhere. And I've had a lot of me pining after boys that didn't pine after me. but I've never properly said, hey, do you want to like go on a proper date where we'll have coffee and see what happens and hopefully we'll see each other again? That's never really been my experience. And I think partially that's because people are afraid to commit to disability. People will sleep with a disabled person and have a sexual encounter to kind of like to put it on their bucket list. It's like, yeah, I was with that guy once.
Yeah.
Check. And then, I mean, and I'm okay being that fetishized to a point, but I'm also, like I was saying earlier, I'm the kind of person that wants to connect. I want to know that somebody wants to come back and see me again. So that's not something that's ever really happened yet. So I feel in many ways, because of that, my relationship knowledge, I'm stunted in that way, because in terms of a relationship, I feel very much like I'm still 16, 17, 18, because I never got to experience that when I was a teenager. As a disabled teenager, I was having surgeries and growing up and doing stuff to make myself more independent. I didn't get to be a reckless teenager like sleeping with everybody.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, because I haven't dated properly, whatever proper is, I don't even know why I'm saying that, but I haven't dated conventionally. I feel like that's still something I want to explore.
That's a fair response. I'm just pondering what I was going to say. My sexual life and my bisexual identity and my disability have almost been three different elements of my life. It's interesting when you said that everything about you is deeply intertwined. My bisexuality is something I know, but not something I've actively leveraged, for want of a better word, in my sex life.
Okay.
My sex life hasn't really... Well, actually, my sex life has explored my disability. My disability was a hurdle in my sex life. Everyone I slept with struggled to process it, and some just flat out left after the date. So I've had a so it's definitely something that's necessary. It's always necessary to hear how to get through these things, and that there are successful, I use the word dating in the broadest sense, successful ways to have a sex life with a disability. And that would be the value of your concept and your podcast, to explore these things and show that it's not always got to be a dead end. Although you even pointed out that's even happened to you, where people just can't cope.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what I do try to come at it from a place of positivity, but more so than positivity, I want to come, why I talk about disability so frankly in the work that I do is because I want to talk about it from a place of reality, not so much like, yeah, disability is great, because that's just not true. I mean, it's not bad, but I'm not, every day I don't wake up and go, I'm disabled today, it's amazing. No, that's not what happens. So when I talk about my experiences being a sexual disabled person, a sexually active queer disabled person, I want to share with my audience, whether it be in the podcast, whether it be in a blog, whether it be in a presentation, P.S. if anybody wants to hire me, I'm totally available. But I talk about, you know, the reality, so people see that there are days that it sucks, and there are days that I'm upset. There are days that I really don't enjoy my disability so much. But I need them to see that side of it, too, so they don't think that I'm trying to overcome anything. I'm living with it. This is my experience, and I love it, and I'm thankful for it. But I don't want to pretend like I'm, yeah, disability is the best. No. Not always. Not every day.
That's something I just remembered something I was going to say to you. Part of the intersectionality that both you and I share, as well as the broadest LGBT connection, is being male. And that does affect processing emotional stuff and being open about who you are, I think.
Yep.
Especially when it's sexual, and so much of sex is about power and thrust.
Are you trying to turn me on, power and thrust? yeah, I agree. I think that, I think a lot of queer men that I've encountered are struggling with this idea of fragile masculinity, and they're taught that to in terms of queer male culture, it's a lot of like, oh, I'm not super feminine, I'm really masculine, but I sleep with guys, and so that's accepted. But the minute you kind of break that down and decide you don't want to be super masculine anymore, or you want to explore your femininity, or you want to explore your emotional side, then you're seen as some sort of weak queer person, and that's just not how I operate. I wear my emotions on my sleeve, and I'm very, very sometimes too honest about that, to the point where I think I've scared people away. But I'm learning to embrace that side of it, because you only live once, and I'd rather be an emotional mess that listens to Adele than not, you know?
Yeah, I hesitate to use the phrase coming out, but in terms of my identifying as a disabled person openly, that came before I was comfortable dealing with the detritus that comes from telling other people that. So I was kind of comfortable in my own space, and then I stepped into the dating arena, and suddenly other people weren't. And it was like, whoa, how do I cope with this? How do I cope with other people not being as comfortable with my disability as I am?
Totally, and that's a culture shock for a lot of disabled people. That's like, whoa, I was raised to believe my disability is great, and now, how are you having a problem with it? What do you mean? Like, you go out of the bubble of safety of your experience and realize that the world is not made for you. The world is not ready emotionally for people with disabilities who are comfortable being people with disabilities. They expect that we are going to be sad, and we're going to be depressed all the time, and we're going to be sitting in our rooms crying about disability, or we're going to do our best to overcome it, disability, and like be as able as possible and be as normal as possible. There's not a lot of discussion, even now about just living with a disability and what that is like. So in my work, I try to really capture how disability feels and what that feels like today, as opposed to looking ahead to like what happens if there's a magical pill that makes me walk, or what happens if, you know, I'm feeling upset today. I try to focus on, in my work, telling people how disability feels and the emotional responses that I get from that. But yeah, I don't think the world is ready for comfortable cripples, if you will. And I think I'm one of those, and I think that scares people a lot.
Well, I'm going to pause to re-ID. You're tuned to 88.1 FM, KPPP, LP, Fargo, Moorhead. From the People's Press Project, this is Technical Difficulties. I'm on the line with Andrew Gerza from Toronto on the subject of disability after dark. And yes, we've covered quite a lot of the intersectionality, and yeah, I've dealt with quite a lot of the fragile masculinity thing. That was my biggest hurdle, because I didn't deal with being queer in my sexual life. I'll be honest, it's not something, well, it's something that my family don't feel comfortable with, because I had such a stunted sexual life when I was younger that they think that my dad's reaction to me coming out was to presume that I'd given up on women.
Yeah, I mean, that's, first of all, sorry about that, that sucks. Secondly, that's so common. People have said that to me too. We're like, oh, you're gay because you couldn't get a girl, right? No, I'm queer because I like men. Thanks. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the whole idea that you're queer and disabled because you couldn't make it as a quote normal man is just wrong. And I also think, with respect to your family, they probably just had like this weird pang of familial worry for you, like, oh well, all this stuff hadn't worked out for him, and so now he's trying this, and what if he gets hurt, and what if things happen, what if,
yeah,
you know. That's probably where it came from.
Yeah, I don't doubt their concern, and you're right. There was a main road at the bottom of our street, and they never let me cross the road. So I know what it's like living as someone with CP. I know that that's the baseline, is concern, and like over-concern. And it's presumably, I don't know, was it? I would guess it would be worse for you. I had mild CP, so to me, they were always exaggerating.
Yeah.
And I felt more able than they thought I was.
I felt that way too. But I also, my mom and I, we were really close. We're extremely close. And when I was younger, my biological father was not in the picture. So I had a stepdad, I still have him. He's great. My family's well intact. But when I was really young, it was my mom and I against the world. So she was very protective of me as a youngster, because I was a wheelchair user, and I needed a lot of care, and I needed people to take care of me, and she wanted to make sure that I was taken care of right. And the cool thing about growing up was that I always knew that I was loved and protected and safe. But I will agree with you that I felt at points like, Mom, you don't have to, I'm okay, like, I'm good, I can do this. And so when I went away to school and started, I was totally free to be a sexual being and to, like, do all this stuff, I felt a really big, like, sense of freedom. I remember at one point I was in the college dorms, and I had never done something. And my friend was like, really? I can't remember what I hadn't done, but I hadn't done something. Really? What do you mean you haven't done that? We've all done that. And I went, well, not me. And I had to, like, explain to them why. And so it was a big sense of, like, oh, I can do this. And so now that I'm grown and I live on my own now, and so my mom, she gives me advice, and I'll listen to her. But it's so much less about, like, Andrew, you have to, because it's like, here's my suggestion now, but I trust you're okay. So that experience, though, that sort of overprotection has kind of subsided into, here's what I think you should do, but I'm going to let you make your own choices, which I think is great, and I think it's such an important evolution for disabled parents. And I can imagine for both of your parents and my parents, that can't be easy to let your kid that you've raised, who needed so much care, who needed so many things from you, to let them, you know, to watch them fall on their face a bit and not be able to help them. So I get why that's probably a bit traumatic for families sometimes.
There's a side to this, and you talk about, it's interesting you just use the word trauma. So, with you and I, the physical side, the last show that aired in this series, I replayed an interview I did about cerebral palsy. So to an extent, we don't need to play over that too much. The mental health side to disability, and especially intersectional disabled lives where there are other factors of repression, for want of a better word, at play, is something that needs to be covered, because it's something that isn't covered enough. Largely because if you're having a mental health crisis, communication is one of the things that goes first.
Yeah.
So talk to me about your experience of how I don't know, for me, I explained it as my physical health affecting my mental well-being, but that just how mental health plays into your life as a disabled queer person.
I would completely agree with you, my physical health playing into my mental well-being. And the way ableism pervades my experience as a queer disabled person, and the way I am constantly feeling about being rejected by men, about not being able to go on dates, about not having enough sex, about not having the sex that I want, all these things have taken a big toll on me, about being sick all the time. Like there was a period in my life where I was in and out of hospitals quite a bit a couple years ago because I had gallbladder disease and things were happening. And so that played a role on my mental health. And then all the stuff of trying to, like I said, trying to date and trying to be sexual and trying to get the sex that all my queer peers I thought were having. Like when we look at queer media, especially queer male media, it looks like men are having sex all the time. And
yeah.
That's something that I craved. I craved that, like, I can be slutty too, yeah. But that really never has seemed to transpire. And when it does, I am left to navigate my disability and make sure that my partner's comfortable. And so that played a big role in my mental health. And there have been times where I still struggle with what I'll refer to as situational depression. I've never been clinically diagnosed, but I would call it situational depression because it's directly tied to disability, and I've gone to therapists, and I've gone to, like, talk therapy and done all that, but I find that when I bring up my disability, the therapist will say to me, when I bring up my disability, my queerness, me, the intersection, the therapist will say, oh, I never realized that, and so you have to spend an inordinate amount of time training the therapist who's supposed to be there giving you, yeah.
Yeah, I was lucky. My therapist, paid for out of pocket, by the way, not covered by the National Health Service. My therapist, I'll cover that in a second, but my therapist was just a kind of spiritual being. So we just spoke about how things affected my sense of being. And the disability was essentially it was a trigger, and so she understood it. And so she understood it on that level, and I was lucky, and I get what you're saying. There's a lot of, because we're only, whatever it is, like 1 in 8. The other 7 in 8 don't have first-hand experience of disability, and some of those other disabled people wouldn't have the communication or cognitive processing skills to be a therapist. So
yeah.
The pool is, and when you get into disabled queer people, that's an even smaller pool of people.
Yeah.
And I'd be surprised if there were that many. But hey, if you're listening to this show and you're a disabled queer therapist, let me know. I'm kind of curious, because let Andrew know, and I will give his contact details out, or I'll let him give his contact details out at the end of the show. Yeah, I get what you're saying, and that kind of also, lots of, I think, mental health issues that are triggered by disability are triggered when we're children, and that's not an age when you go to therapy normally. It's something you have to kind of struggle through and process on your own with everyone else not understanding it, I think.
Yeah, I think that, there are moments in childhood that I remember where people were just downright rude to me. And would be, I remember there was a girl, if she's listening, I'm sorry. There was a girl in elementary school, and we weren't friends. She didn't like me. And I remember one day we were on the playground, and she said to me, "I hope that your entire family ends up in a wheelchair, just like you."
Oh, wow.
And I remember being like 7 or 8 or whatever, however old I was, and I lost my mind. I just remember, I'm not saying that I was an angel. I probably said something either before this or right after that was equally as horrible. But I remember when she said that, it reminded me how disabled I must have looked to the other kids on the playground. And there's a lot of stuff that happened to me when I got older in high school, middle school, when I started falling in love with every boy that I saw, because that's literally what happened. And then, you know, that P.S. that hasn't changed. I still fall in love with every boy I see that I'm attracted to. And that's a trait that I enjoy of myself. I like being a hopeless romantic.
That's under, that's, by the way, undervalued as a trait. I'm a romantic as well. I'm the romantic of the two of me and my wife. It's kind of a running joke. I'm the slushy romantic one. but yeah, go on.
So I first of all, that's awesome. I'm gonna start using slushy romantic one in my bios from now on.
That works.
But, no, I'm extremely emotional, and so I fall in love with all the boys. And so when I got into high school, and I started, I remember there was a guy in school that I really, really liked. I'm not going to name him, but I know, I remember his name. But, I was in love with this guy when we were 15. He was a sports star, beautiful specimen of human at the time. I mean, we're all 15 and gangly, but at that point I thought he was, like, the best thing ever. So I decided one day to tell him that I was gay and that I loved him, because that's the way to go about it. Uh-huh. And so he was like, "Oh, thanks for telling me, man, except I'm not into you that way," as any normal less than 15-year-old boy would do. And I just remember I was crushed, because I was like, "What? I just came out. All the boys are supposed to fall in love with me. What the hell? Why isn't this happening?" So I was very, very kind of hurt that I had come out. I told the truth, and still nobody was falling over my dick, which, you know, that hasn't changed. I've been out as queer and disabled now, both personally and professionally. Well, professionally for about 5 years. This has become my job. But personally for 16 years now, and I'm still struggling with, I've told you who I am, I've showed you who I am, I was honest, why aren't people falling over me to go on dates? So the hopeless romantic part of me has never died, but I think navigating romance and disability can be really hard, because people tell me when I'm too romantic, whoa, you're too intense, you're like coming on too strong there, like, whoa. And that's partially because we as disabled people generally have not been socialized to see ourselves having romance, to be allowed to have romance, to want to have romance. So because we all do want that stuff, when it happens to us, I believe that we kind of get high on the fantasy version that we built up in our heads, because nobody's given us the opportunity to feel that in reality. So we are kind of stuck between what's happening in the real world and what we build up in our heads.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It also brings up, and you mentioned lore at the top of the show, so I have to ask, because I don't actually know, in Canada, what's the situation with the age of consent? Is it the same for gay and straight people?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it is. I'm pretty sure it's the same. I'm pretty sure that it's 16 in Canada. I haven't looked up that in a while.
That's all right. Yeah, the reason I ask, because there's a difference in age. I think there's still a difference in age in England. I'll have to check that as well, because again, I haven't looked it up in a while. But there was for a while, and to me, that just made no sense. It's like, hang on, people are having sexual activity, they're going to have sex anyway. Why does it matter if you're straight or gay, whether you're 16 or 18, which it was at it's a two-year difference between the age of consent when they're all human beings involved.
Because they were concerned about, like, I don't know, that makes no sense. I don't understand either. Like, why were they worried about, like, sodomy? I don't understand what was the reasoning behind it. So if I engage in anal sex with you at 16, somehow it's wrong, but 2 years later it's okay.
Yeah, I don't get that either. I think when it comes to consent, you're talking about the emotional and intellectual maturity of the brain, not the body, to give consent.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time. So 2 years difference is not going to make that much difference. I'm pretty sure I was pretty much the same person at 16 as at 18. And if you're going to have that rule, make it blanket 18, believe that, you know, nothing can happen before you're an adult. But that disparity. So that's interesting. But I just thought, because I didn't know, I've pretty much covered the points I wanted to make. I will let you explain how people can get hold of you. But in this last few minutes, what else do you want the audience listening to this show to understand and believe? What do you want them to take from this chat?
I want them to, I want the audience to take that sex and disability is something we don't talk about enough. There are so many people who are doing this work that are undervalued in the work they do. There are people living with disabilities who are doing this work who deserve to be seen and heard. Anybody who plans sex positivity events, consider hiring A, me, because I'm always looking for work. B, look at making sure your event is accessible. For just the average person listening, if you run across somebody in your world that happens to be disabled and you're kind of into them, you should ask them out and you should explore that with them, and you shouldn't be afraid to give them the time of day, get to know them. I mean, it sounds super cliche, but people are still, I feel like when it comes to disability and sex, people still feel like they're in the dark ages. I did a lecture the other day where somebody asked, one of the questions a student asked me was, how do you have sex? And I've been doing these lectures now for 4 years. Wow. And that's one of the questions that I still consistently get from college age kids, being like, how do you do it? And it's like, okay, wow, all right. So don't be afraid to ask those questions of somebody you may be attracted to. And instead of thinking, like, when people think about sex and disability, one of the questions they consistently ask themselves is, should I date that disabled person? Or would I be able to date that person with a disability? You should always think yes, because somebody with a disability will be able to give you an experience that you've never had before. One of the things I like to say about my disability and my queerness is that I have triple capital when it comes to my disability. It's what I use as my selling point. It's what I use as my jumping off point to the experience of me. So for any disabled people listening who want to, like, engage in their own sexuality, I think you should see your disability as something you can harness and use to find quality people to spend time with and to sell yourself sexually.
I would fully agree with that. I would also argue that it's sort of therapy 101, but if somebody reacts negatively to you because of your disability, it's not about you, it's about them.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's never about you. It's about them being afraid of the fact that they might like it, and they're scared of that. So I think that nobody disabled person has the responsibility to, like, educate somebody, but I do think that disabled people, especially disabled people working in sex and disability, and then deeper than that, disabled queer people, have an opportunity to educate and change somebody's worldview in that one moment, in that one transaction. So when I do lectures, I love talking to students, and I love having them ask me about, you know, the basic, like, oh, how do you have sex? Because when I give them my answer, which is full of, like, pithy, hilarious sex things that I say, but when I talk to them, I'm able to in that moment, the light bulb goes on, and they go, oh, I never thought of it like that before, but now I will. And I think it's really powerful to know that as a disabled person, you have the chance to educate somebody if you want to, and if you have the stamina and desire to do that, because sometimes doing that's, like, exhausting and hard. But yeah, if you can run with that, you know, you could be the reason that somebody's day changes, somebody's life changes, because they met you and then learned some things about disability, which I think is a really, it's like a superpower. It's a cool superpower that only people with disabilities have.
Yeah, that works. Yeah, treat it as a superpower. Well, I'm Crip Man. I will teach you how to understand disability.
Yeah.
It's also a credit to yourself and people like you who step out of their own personal experience and project it. My job always as a journalist is projecting other people's experience. So I get the easy job of just amplifying someone else's well-tuned story. People like you, Andrew, and others who give talks and podcasts, particularly in this era, podcasts about subjects that are otherwise under-discussed, are valuable to the human experience, so that all of us don't have to explain everything.
Oh, totally. And I think that the work that you are doing off of the journalist and doing this, when I was on Twitter and I saw your Tripcast hashtag, I was like, that's amazing. I have to talk to this person. So I think doing this kind of work, though, I hope that it does two things. I hope that it gives people with disabilities a chance to feel like they have a place in the world, and they have, and these experiences they're having, they don't feel so alone. And I hope that it also gives the larger population a chance to reflect on themselves and a chance to realize that, oh, you know, it's not so nice to be prejudiced against that disabled guy that was just asking me out, or it's not fair that this disabled person doesn't get to go to the clubs, or it's not fair that he never goes on enough dates. It gives them a chance to look at their own ableism and confront it, and hopefully make a change in their lives and make a change in how they view disability.
Well, we're pretty much up to the hour. So just to wrap back through, Disability After Dark is a newish project that you launched, but you've been doing other things. So tell the audience where they can get hold of you and what you're up to now and what you're up to going forward.
Yeah. Well, what I'm up to now, I'm just producing more podcasts. I just produced episode 12 yesterday, which is coming out this Friday on iTunes and Google Play. Also on my website, www.andrewgerza.com. I am hoping to get more speaking gigs. I'm working on some up-and-coming book chapters. I would love to transform my blogs that I've written for HuffPost and for other outlets into a kind of book series. So if anybody who's a publisher out there is listening wants to contact me, I don't know how to do any of that, but I'd love to. I'm really just working at building the brand and getting my name out there.
And we appreciate your time, Andrew. Thanks for coming on the line. It's been really nice talking to you. There's no really succinct way to... I'm used to live radio. When the time runs out, you just close the fader and walk off. So I'm not used to kind of a smooth ending yet. So I'm just going to say, thanks very much for coming on, Andrew. If I have time, I'm going to be squeezing in People Are Strange by the Doors. So we'll see. So that is it for our conversation with Andrew Gerza. Down the line over Skype from Toronto. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Oh, thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
For everyone here at KPPPLP, I'm Tim Abbott. Wear your scars with pride. And remember, we all have technical difficulties. Goodbye. And whilst I've got time, I will add, to get hold of us, you can look for the hashtag Cryptcast, Twitter at LightChronic, Facebook search for Technical Difficulties Radio Show. As I've said before, a couple of subjects we're trying to hit in going forward are the relationship between police brutality and disability and the Crip the Vote hashtag going forward with the US election. Thanks for your time, Andrew. It's been nice talking to you.
It was great. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.